The second case set for argument this morning is Yuri Real Estate versus Benjamin and Leslie Tronas. Jonathan Haber is here on behalf of the appellant plaintiffs and will be arguing, and Caitlin Cook is present on behalf of Appalese and will be arguing. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Mr. Haber, you'll have a 5-minute rebuttal. You can proceed with your argument at this time.
Chief Justice, Justices of the Bench. Good morning. I represent Yuri Realty Corporation and Yuri Property Management Corporation. This case is essentially a case about commissions. My client did everything he was asked to do to collect commissions on the sale of a residential home. And my property management client did everything it was supposed to do to lease and manage the property and collect compensation related to that management. There are primarily three issues on appeal today, one being Yuri Realty Corporation's entitlement to a commission from the sale of the residential home. The issue is whether or not the circuit court erred in finding in favor of appellees, the Tronases, on the breach of the listing agreement. The second issue relates to the breach of a property management agreement and whether or not the circuit court erred in granting summary judgment on that issue. And the third issue is whether or not the court erred in awarding attorney fees to appellees under the listing agreement. If I may, I'll take those in reverse order in the order that they show up in the briefs and take up what I consider the simplest of the three issues, and that's the issue of attorney's fees. Attorney fees are allowed by statute or they are allowed by contract. There's no dispute in this case. There's no statute on point that would allow attorney fees, and the circuit court didn't award attorney fees under any statute. Instead, the circuit court awarded attorney fees under the listing agreement to the appellees, the Tronases, under the theory that they were the prevailing parties. The rule of law in South Dakota is that the terms of the contract apply. And this court need look no further than the actual language in the listing agreement to decide whether or not attorney fees are even allowed to be granted to appellees in this case. And by the language of the listing agreement, they are not. The listing agreement requires that a party be in breach. And no party was found to be in breach of the listing agreement by the circuit court. And so the inquiry ends right there.
How did the court get this wrong?
Well, in my view, this is my view, the court solicited findings of fact and conclusions of law from the parties, and the conclusions of law and the findings of fact related to the attorney fees are verbatim what was proposed, and that was what was signed.
So that's what I was going to ask. Was there an argument made that the contract just doesn't allow them in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. That was made via the proposed findings and conclusions that we submitted and also our objections.
So there weren't oral arguments. It's solely in the findings and conclusions.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And the judge never actually ordered attorney's fees. It was appealed. And so we're looking at an order that says that the Tronases are entitled to fees, not the fee award itself.
Correct, Your Honor. There was a hearing after the fact, after the notice of appeal was filed, and regarding fees, and the circuit court stayed any decision on reasonableness of fees and looked toward the Supreme Court to make a decision on whether or not fees are allowed. So here we are. And then second of all, regarding the attorney fees, The Tronuses never moved to enforce the listing agreement against a breaching party. There were no claims made by the Tronuses to enforce any breach, and because there was no breach, that entitlement fails for multiple reasons. The second issue is relating to the management agreement and the circuit court's granting of summary judgment on that issue. Unfortunately, there are no findings or conclusions, or if there are, they're sparse related.
We wouldn't have findings and conclusions for a summary judgment order.
And there's none, there's no, and there's no rationale given.
No rationale.
My apologies, Your Honor. No rationale given at the hearing as to the reasoning. And so for this court's review, the standard review is whether or not there were any genuine issues of material fact when viewed in the light most favorable to my client, UPM. And we would argue that there's multiple genuine issues of material fact. One is there was an issue related to whether or not the management agreement was validly terminated. The language, again, I think all three issues in this case are contract issues, and again, we're back at a contract issue. And the
how would that be a disputed issue of material fact if it's a interpreting contract?
Well,
I might have got the law wrong, and I'm happy to hear your argument on that. But how was that a disputed issue of material fact?
Your Honor, I agree with you. In fact, and the insinuation that that's more of a conclusion of law that can be decided de novo, and I would agree with you. I think there are, were certain issues that could be decided de novo, and I think the court got those wrong related to the termination and related to accrual of compensation under the management agreement. Our position would be that those payments accrued upon consummation of the lease.
So there aren't material issues of fact and dispute. It's a question of law.
I do believe there's material issues related to the good faith and fair dealing covenant. And I think that's replete with genuine issues of material fact that the court couldn't decide at that time. And I think the facts in this case prevented summary judgment from being granted on that issue. Because what we do have here in this case is we have the appellees made efforts to interfere with the lease agreement between UPM and David Pifke, the lessee. There was an 18-month lease, and that only allowed to be terminated under certain circumstances which weren't met, and prevented that property from being sold to anybody else other than David Pifke. And so through those efforts, we believe thwarted the spirit of the deal, which was to lease the property and collect profits.
If you're right on that, and if there was a disputed issue of material fact relating to that conduct, is that a different good faith and fair dealing argument than the good faith and fair dealing argument relating to the listing agreement? Is it different? Or is it the same one? Because it seems like it's the same one. It seems like you're saying the Tronuses got in the way and went to the house and bothered the Pifkes and got them to come over and buy. That seems like the same one, but maybe it's different.
Your Honor, I think it's very, very similar, but I do think ultimately the objective is different. One is whether or not thwarting the spirit of the deal to collect a commission on the sale of the property, and one is whether or not it was thwarting the lease. And so here we have, Your Honor.
Well, the reason I ask is because even if the judge was wrong in granting summary judgment and there were disputed issues of material fact, if factually those disputed material facts were the ones that ultimately got tried in the court trial, they lost on the facts. And so I'm trying to figure, you know, it's almost as if, you know, is there a prejudice or a harmlessness argument there? Because if the judge missed that, those same factual issues got tried on the listing agreement. I'm trying to see if that's significant.
Mm-hmm. I do think it is significant, Your Honor, because I do think the nature of the claim is somewhat different. While the underlying facts do overlap, certainly, and the conduct certainly overlaps, I do think the intent is different between the two, because one would be an intent to thwart the spirit of the deal to collect the real estate commission for URC, and the other one would be to thwart a lease agreement. And at trial, we never had the opportunity to go into testimony about what the expectation was for the lease agreement and what the revenue was for the lease agreement and what UPM's entitlement to those fees were, because that's a separate company that was had a contract with a lessee, and the appellees, through their conduct, interfered with that and sold the property in a way that prevented them from collecting any of that revenue, and did so in a way that, in fact, I think as the testimony came out for the circuit court, was, and David Pifke was found to be credible, and he testified, he was worried that that lease that's at subject for the UPM was going to be breached by appellees. And because of their fear that they were going to breach it and sell it to somebody else, which was prevented under the lease, Pifke capitulated and bought the property earlier. And earlier meant less money for UPM. And so to that end, I think that theory wasn't fully evaluated at trial.
But there was always the prospect of selling the property. Everybody seems to agree to that. The question really is who gets paid, because it was ultimately sold. Mr. Urey even sent an email congratulating the Tronises on the sale of the home initially. So everyone seemed to expect that the house was going to get sold. And so are you saying that the termination of the lease agreement is the manifestation, the damage, if you will, from the breach of the good faith and fair dealing? Because it seems like everybody kind of hoped that it would get sold. Or is it more the operation of the agreement, that of the management agreement, that gets you this fair dealing, good faith and fair dealing argument?
Well, Your Honor, I do agree. I think everyone did want the property to get sold, and I think that was the case from the very beginning. And I think the dueling theories here are more along the lines of there should be compensation for something. And for the appellees to neither compensate under the property management agreement, neither compensate under the listing agreement, is thwarting any level of compensation for what was exactly the purpose of those contracts. And so to that end, I do think the issues are different enough that they should have been tried, but I do admit they do overlap and are quite similar. And to that end, I do want to make sure I have time for the listing agreement, because if that was ultimately the purpose of bringing in David Pifke as a potential purchaser of the property and a lessee, because of his good credentials to ultimately buy the property, and ultimately he did. It was discussed from the very beginning that he was going to be potentially a purchaser, and he thought he had more time to purchase, but then ultimately did it when he did it. It was no surprise when he ultimately did purchase. And as to the listing agreement, again, I think this can be considered, most of this can be considered de novo as a matter of law, especially taking some of the findings that were made by the court. I think what the listing agreement says is simply that URC or somebody else procure a purchaser during the term of the agreement. There's no language related to an offer being made during the term of the agreement. There's no language related to a purchase agreement must be entered into during the term of the agreement as it relates to procurement. There are certain ways the listing agreement can be invoked for compensation.
You procure at the price or upon terms stated above, or any other price or upon any other terms accepted by the seller during the agreement. It sounds like the seller's got to sign off on procuring during the term of the agreement.
Right. And so my reading of that language is, or at any other price or upon any other terms accepted by the seller during the term of the agreement. I think whether or not you relate the clause during the term of the agreement only to upon any other terms accepted by the seller or to the entire provision, I think that URC prevails either way. The terms that were ultimately acceptable to that were ultimately put into the purchase agreement were acceptable. That was in the listing agreement itself, listed what the terms that were acceptable to.
But they weren't accepted by the seller during the term of the agreement. They were accepted later, much later.
Well, I think ultimately the price and the terms selling to this purchaser were accepted and acceptable because URC had the right to sell to PIFKI during the term of the agreement. And I think what procuring and the language related to procuring and what South Dakota Supreme Court has said related to that term, I think URC falls completely within having procured David PIFKI during the term of the agreement.
That depends upon facts, though. This unbroken chain, causal chain that relates back to Mr. Urie ultimately. And so at the court trial, the judge found against Mr. Urie and his company on that and said, actually, the Tronuses were the ones that prompted him. I'm sorry, can I finish this?
Go ahead.
They're the ones that prompted this sale, so there's really not this unbroken chain. So I know the agreement would be reviewed de novo, but that factual finding seems like it would be reviewed under clear error.
May I answer? I'm out of time.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honors. My answer to that would be the circuit court didn't, based on my read of the findings of fact and conclusions of law, didn't get into procurement at all. In fact, found that because no offer was accepted during the term, that was the end of it. And so if the court looks at what conclusions of law were relating to procurement, it's devoid of any of that analysis. And so I don't think, based on my read of the findings of fact and conclusions of law, either it wasn't considered as procurement, or it was and it wasn't considered under the appropriate law, as to the findings of fact and conclusions of law submitted by appellants, or third, we believe was interpreted incorrectly. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Hayward. Ms. Cook, you may proceed with your argument.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, law clerks. My name is Caitlin Cook, and I represent the appellees and defendants Benjamin and Leslie Tronus. I'm not used to going second, so this is new for me in front of this court. But I want to hit on a couple points just right out of the gate that counsel raised with regard to, first, the property management agreement. Your Honor, Justice Salter, I think you hit it on the head. The facts that were pertinent to their claim for breach of implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing relating to the listing agreement are the same facts that pertain to the argument regarding the breach of covenant of good faith and fair dealing with regard to the property management agreement. I do think there is one important distinction here, though, in that the language of the property management agreement specifically gives the Tronuses it's a right, it's a contractual right to terminate that they exercised. And the breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, it doesn't supplant the terms of the actual contract. So it would be the Tronuses' position, how can I have committed bad faith in exercising a contractual right that I'm given under the plain terms of the property management agreement? So I agree with Justice Salter that at trial, the court had the opportunity to weigh the evidence, to determine the credibility and the sincerity of the witnesses, and also to take everything in context to determine that there was no breach of the implied covenant. But also, under Supreme Court law, you can't commit bad faith if there's a specific term of that contract that controls here, and it did give them a right of termination. So with regard to the property management agreement, that is the Tronuses' position. If I may, I'd like to touch on the listing agreement. I respectfully disagree with counsel that simply because the trial court did not adopt their proposed findings, it doesn't mean that the trial court did not analyze the issue of procurement. If you look at the plain language of the listing agreement, and as your honors know, this is a question of law, you review it de novo, whatever I tell you it says doesn't matter, it's up to your interpretation of the same. But as was discussed earlier, there's a bookend at the end of that first part of the listing agreement with regard to entitlement to a fee. That bookend is accepted by the seller during the term of this agreement. So I would posit, your honors, that you could, or the trial court could find, in fact, that appellants did procure Mr. PIFKI and the tenant as a buyer. It still doesn't matter because it wouldn't have happened. There were no terms accepted by the seller during the term of the agreement.
Yeah, I mean, the factual findings from the circuit court, once this was all laid bare at the court trial, seemed pretty clearly oriented to the idea that Mr. Pifke was quite happy leasing the property until early 2021, March timeframe, when it really got, and he perceived that, you know, they might sell it out from underneath him. But up until that point, and there's factual findings that document that whole area of the evidence. So this ended on October 31st, 2020. So we're now, whatever that is, 6 months later, five, whatever my math is.
And, Your Honor, I think that's exactly, you're hitting the nail on the head in that that is exactly the purpose of that 180-day tail period, is to give some cushion. But the sale still didn't even happen within the term of the 180-day tail period. The tenant didn't even know the tail period existed. So to argue that, you know, somehow, if they wanted an unlimited tail period, they could have put it in the listing agreement.
It's a coincidence that this is the following day.
Your Honor, I understand, and I will admit that does not look good. And I will be the first one to say that, and those are conversations that I've had with my client. But again, the trial court had the opportunity to listen to the sincerity of the testimony from Mr. Tronis. There's evidence in the record that they were desperately trying to sell this South Dakota home to close on a Colorado home. Ben testified to that effect. So, yes, it doesn't look good. But that doesn't mean that it's wrong as a matter of law or that there was some breach of some implied covenant. Under the plain language of all of the agreements we're looking at here, it just simply doesn't fit. And if we read it the way that appellants would like it to be read, there's no end. They could sell this property to the Pifkeys 25 years from now, and somehow they would still be entitled to that commission because you're not looking at the end bookend.
It may not be determinative of the outcome or your arguments, either one of you, but I actually had a question on that because the agreement says, I know what happened, you know, the purchase agreement was signed or it reached their agreement one day after the tail period, but procurement's not really oriented to the tail period. Procurement's oriented to the contract period, not the tail period. So I was thinking that we were working with October 31st as the date on that one. And, you know, the tail period was the tail period, but the tail period really only mattered for that period when someone who was shown the property earlier winds up buying, and that everyone knows, well, I don't know, he's got an option argument on that, but that's not the procure theory.
Yes, and I would agree with you on that, Your Honor. Within the term of the actual listing agreement itself, which is October 31st of 2020, it is either the purchase, the exchange, or the option. The way that I interpret the remaining provision with regard to the tail period is exactly, as you said, Your Honor, the property being sold to someone to whom it was shown. And that didn't happen here either.
And he could exercise the option in the tail period, too.
Your Honor, I would say I would agree with
was
you.
Was I wrong on that?
No, I would agree with you that the option wouldn't necessarily have to be exercised within the tail period. I don't think this is an option contract. Simply as a matter of law, you can't have it both ways here. So initially in the motion for summary judgment that my clients brought early on in the case, appellants took the position that the lease itself was an option contract. They allude to these separate emails between the tenant and the property management company, but they didn't ever actually came out and said these are a separate contract. Later on in the case, they proposed that now these emails are a separate option contract. It doesn't fit the requirements of an option contract under South Dakota law. There's no specified price. There's no specified time. Appellants say, well, you can infer that it's the listing price. Well, if it's a contract, then those terms need to be in the contract. You can't have it both ways where it's piecemeal here and here to try to fall within that term of the listing agreement. So the option contract just simply doesn't fit. Both Mr. Tronis and Mr. Pifke testified at trial that they did not have an understanding that there was any form of an option or exclusivity here. And I don't believe that an agent can just bind a principal while the two parties to the contract don't actually know they're in a contract. So I think if that was, I think clearly in the lease and the context at trial, the 18-month period was just simply so they didn't have to up and move again after moving across the country to South Dakota in less than a year. And I think the contract and the court had the opportunity to take that all in context, not just this limited email that you're presented with today, to determine whether he thought that that was a valid argument or not, and he didn't. So with regard to the listing agreement and the option, simply put, the facts don't bear out that anything happened such that a right to a commission would be triggered here.
Counsel, can you address the fees issue? He argues no breach, no fees.
Your Honor, as counsel correctly pointed out, all of the agreements here are governed by the de novo standard of review. We differ on our interpretation of that, but ultimately this court has every right to step in and interpret it. I can say that I think that it would be construed to an absurd result to say that a frivolous, not frivolous, but a lawsuit could be filed against, you know, the sellers in this case, and they have no recourse.
That's the American rule, though.
It is, Your Honor.
How could that be absurd?
Your Honor, I just don't know that in looking at the listing agreement, I mean, in that instance, it essentially, there are very few issues or instances where I can imagine that the sellers would ever have recourse. And if that's what this court determines, that is the law. So there's not much more that I can say with regard to that. We differ on our interpretation of it as briefed, but that is the standard and ultimately is up to this court and the trial court below to have decided that. I would like to touch a little bit further on the implied covenants of good faith and fair dealing. That's governed by a completely different standard here than the de novo standard of review with regard to the contractual interpretation. As the court has pointed out, it's a clearly erroneous standard, and that's very important. We have the trial court to do exactly the function that the trial court performed here, which is to determine whether the evidence bears out what the parties are saying. There are certain references within the briefing to say that, oh, you know, the trial court downplayed certain things, or the trial court, you know, didn't give enough weight here. That's up to the trial court. That's why we have the trial court. This court, you know, unless you find that there is a definite and firm conviction that there is something, that an error was made with regard to those facts that were found, this court should not step in. And, Your Honor, you're right. It doesn't look good. But the trial court sat there for an entire day after reviewing, you know, multiple briefs from the parties in advance of that and came to these conclusions with citations to the record. So to the extent that there's any argument regarding a breach or an error in the trial court's findings in that regard, that's a high standard and there's a reason for that. Do I get in trouble if I leave too much time? Thank you. I'm going to rest.
Thank you, Ms. Cook. Mr. Haber, you can proceed with your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to go back to the language in the listing agreement related to procurement. That provision states, if a purchaser is procured for the property by the broker, by any other cooperating broker, by the seller, or by any other person at the price and upon the terms stated above, comma, or at any other price or upon any other terms accepted by the seller during the term of this agreement. I believe there's two different clauses here at play. One is at the price and upon the terms stated above, which are in the listing agreement. And then one is, or at any other price or upon any other terms accepted by the seller during the term of this agreement. I think Your Honors can find that the tenant, David Pifke, who ultimately purchased the property, was procured for the terms of the listing agreement during the term of the agreement.
Didn't the buyer and the seller ultimately negotiate their own price on their own terms and conditions?
Your Honor, what happened, and at least how the record reflects, is that the Mr. Pifke made an offer of $500, which was more, $25,000 approximately more than what was in the listing agreement. The Tronuses, Benjamin Tronus specifically testified at trial, he would have accepted $475 had that been offered. So the only reason more was offered, Mr. Pifke testified, was he was worried the lease was going to get breached and he was going to get into a bidding war. And so I think it would be an unfair technical interpretation to say that because someone offers more money that a real estate broker shouldn't get a commission.
So, but, yeah, I mean, I'm having a hard time finding any real difference between the price upon the term stated above or any other price that the seller agrees to, because in both of those instances, the idea is that the seller is on board with this. Either you're doing it on my price or it's a different price, but I've agreed to it. So whether it was 500 is more than 475, whether that's on the terms or whatever, there's no question that the seller agreed to it. I don't think. So what's your procure theory?
Thank you, Your Honor. And I would like to get to that because I think procurement is been addressed by the Supreme Court in the Melberg case. And this court has specifically said procuring cause is one originating a series of events which, without a break in their continuity, result in the accomplishment of the prime object of the broker's employment. That's exactly what happened here. In fact, the parties communicated at all times. The whole purpose of this was to sell the property. The only reason it was being leased anyways was because it was trying to generate some income in between that time of selling the property.
I don't know if the factual findings from the court trial support that argument.
I think they do, Your Honor, because I think that the circuit court found that Uri found Mr. Pifke, okay, and he brought Mr. Pifke to the Tronuses. He put Mr. Pifke in the house, and that all is supported by the findings. We think the findings are clearly erroneous as to whether or not the parties discussed purchase of the property, because I think the emails that the court can observe discuss Mr. Pifke purchasing the property, or at least Mr. Pifke talking about purchasing the property. It was certainly discussed.
Yeah, it was discussed, but he said he didn't want to do it.
Well, he said he didn't want to do it right then. And the reason for that was the reasons he gave. He was moving from Las Vegas. He wanted to see if he could handle the winters and so on and so forth. But ultimately, whether or not he wanted to do it right then doesn't really matter for whether or not Mr. Pifke was procured, because procurement is a very broad concept and has been analyzed by many secondary authorities and many other jurisdictions as well as dictionaries. To Black's Law Dictionary, for example, says to obtain something by special effort or means. And to achieve or bring about a result. That's exactly what happened. None of this would have happened but for Uri finding Mr. Pifke, placing Mr. Pifke in the house, and continuing to have those communications for a period of months during the term of the agreement still related to purchasing. It was reaching out at the instruction of the Tronuses to sell the property, and ultimately, voila, Mr. Pifke purchased the property. That's all. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.